And we are back with episode 428 of The Critical Myth. I am John, your host, and tonight we have...
Edmund from Greenville, and, well, that went from Lord of the Flies to Dropping Like Flies.
This is Gary from Jacksonville, and, you know, when you ask people for help, you think they would help you, but sometimes it just doesn't work out that way.
No.
And this is Bronson from Australia, and, yeah, I can't think of a good joke about technical difficulties.
You're having technical difficulties finding a joke about technical difficulties. All right. Well, hopefully
that would be would have been a funny joke that I was having technical difficulties.
Mm. Indeed. All right. Well, hopefully the connection, the tin can and string down to Australia will continue to work as we continue with this episode. But Edmund, if you could give a disclaimer first.
Yes, we will talk about just about anything that might have happened in these episodes, so you will be spoiled. But we try and wait a week or so before we do that, so hopefully you won't.
That's right. Okay. And while we have Bronstum, why don't we go ahead and let him choose our first topic? What would you like to talk about?
I have a hankering to talk about the latest Arrow.
Okay. And here's the promo.
They're calling you Deathstroke.
It's a little flamboyant, but I like it.
This isn't my home.
You're not going home.
Somebody help me!
Now what?
Now we fight back.
Where's Thea? Where?
What are you gonna do? Kill me?
Once you let the darkness inside, it never comes out.
And if you could do the recap...
Sure. I just go on my page. Arrow Season 2, Episode 18, Deathstroke. Slade makes his move against Oliver, and the repercussions are severe. Oliver desperately tries to protect his family, but one key player on his team questions his decisions. Meanwhile, Isabel attempts to take Queen Consolidated away from Oliver.
Hmm. All right. And let's see. Gary, did you happen to watch this episode as well? I know that you watched last week's, but...
Yes, I did.
And what would you give this one?
Yes, I did, yes.
What would you give it?
I would give it a 7.
7, ooh boy. Okay, and Bronstum, how about you?
I would go a lot higher than that. I'd go a 9.
And Edmund?
9 as well.
Yeah, I'm on a 9 too. All right, well... Bronstum, briefly, what would you say put this at a 9 for you?
The way that so many of the recurring characters and storylines and stuff like that really, really tied together and did so in a way that they became a story of their own. It was tense. It was interesting. It forced all the characters to... It put them all in different sort of emotional places. It generated sort of drama and tension between, the heroes. It set up Slade as an even bigger and better and badder villain than we've had before. Everything about the episode just took things that had been awesome about the show before and made them a bit more awesome.
Hmm. Okay. Now, Gary, I know that you're only recently kind of picking back up on this show as of last week, but what was your reason for going with a 7 for this one?
Well, for a guy that's, maybe I'm missing subtleties in it, I don't care for the actor playing Slade so much. He seems, it's not quite a match for me, so I'm having a hard time with that. But that aside, I guess he's trying to be more subtle about destroying Oliver from the bottom up, so to speak, but it seems almost a little too subtle for a man who sort of seems sort of physical and sort of going after things. It seems a little bit too measured almost to drag this out, even if it seems like he'd want to take one or two more direct pokes at him, even if it wasn't the coup de grace against him, rather than just attacking him through his family and his business and things like that. So that I had a bit of a hard time with. The whole sister aspect with the sort of the finale where, with the tease about finding out who he is just seems a little bit lame to me. So it's not that it was bad. I feel a 5 is a medium. 5 or 6 is you know, medium, and 7 is better than average. So it was good, but it was lacking. Maybe I'm not grounded enough in the series to have seen more of it to be more invested in some of the plot devices, but it just struck me as a little flat.
Yeah, I can see how if you didn't have a lot of the season leading up to this to really kind of develop the rapport with Slade and what he's been doing this whole time, then yeah, I can understand why that might fall a little bit flat. But Edmund, what would you like to add to this?
Yeah, certainly I'd agree that I think this is one case where you really do need some of the build up to the way they've been presenting Slade, and in particular, I think what the surprise with this was precisely the fact that he was being this subtle about it. From what you've seen of him developing on the island and the initial stages of the Mirakuru, he is much more direct, much more emotional, and you get that sense of that Slade would have been much more physical. And even though it was back on the island that he first gives the threat of I'm going to show you what despair is and take down everything you hold dear, you didn't really get that the sense that person could pull off what he's starting here. So I think within that context, it this does make more sense and have more impact. And the ways where things are getting stripped away, where all these decisions that Oliver's made are just backfiring on him, from the decision not to tell Thea about her dad, the way he was trying to bring Roy and train him with the Mirakuru to try and avoid some of what Slade went through, and having that both leave Thea vulnerable and lead Roy to flee, so that Slade manages to not that Roy necessarily was a huge threat, being the neophyte Mirakuru recipient as opposed to his veteran one, and obviously he wasn't trained as a mercenary to begin with, but just to pare the team down like that. The only thing that kept it in mind for me was the whole thing with Isabel and the Queen consolidated takeover just seemed to it wasn't set up well. Having her just come back, and even though yes, it's been obvious that Oliver hasn't been paying attention to the business, having it all just come back and come to a head here, where it's the moment you see him signing over his position, you just know what's going to happen. So that just fell a little flat to me. And certainly her being in league with Slade, so that Slade now has all of the resources of Queen Consolidated to make his army. That was the one thing that just didn't quite work for me, but a lot of the other stuff did. And if anything, I just got at the very end there, the final reveal of Slade telling Laurel who Oliver was. There was a part of me that was saying, you know, you should have figured it out anyway, but here's Slade to tell you.
I
took that as this kind of bait.
Go ahead.
Oh, you go.
I was going to say. All right. There were two things that I took away from this, and the first one was, Edmund, I completely know what you mean at the end of the episode. As cool as I thought that it was that they finally went there, I really wanted the dramatic music, and then, you know, the music stops and he goes, no, really, you didn't notice? He has the face, the beard. That'd be the end of it, right? But then the other thing that I really love was that this was... And Gary, I can definitely see how this wouldn't have necessarily been obvious, but this was the big first reveal of Slade in action as Deathstroke, in the full armor and outfit and everything. And it was, you know, a season's worth almost of build up to this point, and the anticipation was there, and yeah, it was great to see all this unfold. The one thing that took it down from a 10 to a 9 was, as Edmund, you said, the whole thing with Isabel was almost laughable comparative to all of that. It was like, Oliver, you're supposed to be smarter than this. Why would you write over a proxy to this person whose motives you still question? It's... But anyway, Bronstam, you were going to jump in with something?
You were talking about sort of the idea of like Slade's manipulation approach and his the way he's dealing with allies and stuff like that. And I actually really enjoyed a lot of that stuff. I get the distinct impression that he really doesn't give like he really does not give a toss about blood or about Queen Consolidator or anything like that. It's just like all he wants is revenge, and these people will be handy. So for the time being, he's acquiring the things that they want where it works in as part of his plan. And there's going to be a point, almost Malcolm Merlyn style, I expect, where he just tells them to jog on. As to the thing with Laurel at the end of the episode, I sort of saw this really interesting kind of bait and switch in him trying to sort of put the psychological hooks into Oliver by teasing him with the notion that his system might know the secret, might know his secret, and then it's actually something else altogether. And then he just think, well, phew, I'm off the hook. And then Laurel, and then just out of nowhere, because Lord knows none of us figured Laurel would be able to work it out on her own, so he's probably thinking the same thing. Out of nowhere, Laurel suddenly knows, and it'll just be this interesting blindside, I think. I think this was Slade's best episode yet. And you said it, like, this is the first time seeing him, like, in the full, like, you know, armored, hardcore version of his outfit. I mean, what we've seen on the island has been really, really impressive. But we've been seeing him as basically a gorilla, a commando. And then we've seen him sort of, like, struggling with superpowers. And now we're really seeing a Slade who is completely in command of himself.
Yeah. Yeah.
And his object, like, you know, combining his training with his abilities and stuff like that. And when we see him just standing in the middle of the road in that gear, there is this real palpable sense of like, this guy was a threat before, but he has never felt so dangerous, so threatening. This feels like the biggest, baddest thing that Team Arrow has ever had to deal with.
It also was the scene that launched 1,000 cosplays. You just know.
God, I want to do one. That would be awesome. Yeah, and right? I would actually have the right accent for it.
Yes, you would. For once. All right. Any other thoughts on this episode? You know, Gary, you know, I definitely know what you're talking about. This would have been one of those things where it's like me watching the season finale for Hannibal or something like that. It just would be a complete flop for me, not having seen all of the build up to it. And if, you know, if I wasn't particularly taken with the guy playing Slade, either, I could see how that would detract a bit from it. But
I did like the Roy tensions. I thought that was done really well. And I think it's sort of, you know, it's awkward, but at the same time, it fits the storyline. I like that a lot, and that the tension that brings.
And that was a good combination
that I did
too.
Like a lot.
Yeah, because that's been building for a little while too. So that was good to see that play out as well. Really, I mean, when Oliver says that it's all just coming down on him all at once, every stupid mistake that he's made. Yeah, that's exactly what it is that's happening, and it's both internal and external. So it's going to be fun seeing him dig his way out of this. And I love the fact that Malcolm Merlyn is just waiting in the background. And it's going to kind of... Something's going to happen there sooner or later. For all we know, Slade is just, you know, a weapon being pointed in that direction he's not even aware of. But we'll find out. Anyhow, let's go ahead then and move on to our next topic. And Gary, why don't you go ahead and pick the next one?
I'd like to talk about Agents of S.H.I.E.L.D.
All right. Let's go ahead and run the promo.
All new next Tuesday, a Marvel Maximum event.
We call him Deathlok.
Fear unleashed.
I want to know exactly what Deathlok is capable of.
Danger exposed.
There's someone else down there.
For the Agents of S.H.I.E.L.D., trust...
What just happened?
...is destroyed.
You've been betrayed.
What the hell?
Put it down!
Marvel's Agents of S.H.I.E.L.D. Uprising continues all new next Tuesday at 8, 7 Central, featuring an exclusive look at Marvel's Captain America The Winter Soldier on ABC.
Okay, and if you could do the recap.
Absolutely. Agents of S.H.I.E.L.D., Season 1, Episode 16, End of the Beginning. The S.H.I.E.L.D. agents close in on the clairvoyant with help from Garrett and Triplett. Meanwhile, They must contend with their former ally, Mike Peterson, now reborn as the cyborg Deathlok. I have to say, my fanboy I give this a 9.
A 9? Okay. And Edmund, how about you?
I will give it a 9 as well.
Okay. Bronson, did you happen to catch this one?
The same.
Okay. And
9 out of 10.
I'm going to be the one to kind of break this a little bit with an 8.5. Ha, see, I told you we could do...
You rebel. Yeah.
I know. I'm rebelling. From a
really going
machine.
Out there, yeah.
Yeah, so really serving a bit as a prelude to Captain America, the Winter Soldier, in its own little way, as it prepares to do what is a semi-parallel storyline, although where the overlaps are will be intriguing to see. I'm going to keep my mouth shut because I think I'm the only one here who's actually seen the Winter Soldier. So hopefully by the time this goes out, maybe that won't be true. But I'll just say that certainly there are things that have been building on this show that surprisingly I feel tie into the movie even more than even perhaps Bronstam even suspects. But Gary, give me your thoughts on this. 9 is a really high score. So what was the you said it was you
well,
kind
no,
of
like I,
geeking out about it for as a Marvel fan. So
oh yeah, yeah.
What were the highlights there?
My squeal moment was with Mike, or I guess I got to get in the habit of calling him Deathlok, I guess now, was when they did the scan of him and it looked exactly like the comic book character.
Yeah.
With all the, the implants, because obviously Mike doesn't look like the character, but when they did that scan, it was a real sort of little tip of the hat because the scan looked exactly like the several versions of the comic book character. So I was like, oh, that's so cool. Look, they're like giving us him, but even though we think we don't get to see him. But so I like that a lot. I enjoyed the handling of Skye this episode. She wasn't this sort of miracle tech person. She wasn't this, maiden who needed protection. She was made a full agent, and she was like, working on the computer system, doing a job. It wasn't some miraculous thing done. It wasn't that she was in some sort of trouble that she needed help with. She was just a functioning member of the team. I liked to see that instead of her woe is me or here's the Wunderkind, to save the day. So I like that little fit to it. I love the ambiguousness that Coulson gave to the clairvoyant. How do we know who this person is? They never even spoke. Who do we know? How do we know who was talking through the computer? I love the moral ambiguity that was brought into that sort of statement.
Yeah. Well,
go ahead, Evan.
Yeah. What I particularly liked about that was when the credits rolled at the beginning and you see Brad Dourif's name come up and you're like, oh, okay, he's got to be the villain. He's always the villain. And then they show him in this situation where it's like, no, this doesn't feel right.
They showed him like perfectly for what you would expect for a super villain kind of character in this kind of show. Between who they cast and the way they presented that scene and stuff like that, the producers, like the writers, the producers, all that, were going to as much effort to convince the audience as the actual clairvoyant was to convince all these S.H.I.E.L.D. agents.
Yep.
And I always appreciate it when a show or a movie or something like that puts in kind of meta effort. And for those who have seen Iron Man 3, not unprecedented by Marvel.
Yeah, exactly. And considering how much of Iron Man 3 has been factoring into this season of Agents of S.H.I.E.L.D., it makes perfect sense.
Well, it was the only one that they knew would be out by the time that the show started production.
Yeah. I will say this. It's obvious to me, based on that and a few other things that have happened, that this whole Phase 2 thing that Joss Whedon has been shepherding is tying together in ways that I think even people will be shocked to discover. Because especially after the somewhat disappointing overlap between the Thor the Dark World and Agents of S.H.I.E.L.D., which is perhaps not the most natural overlap in the world. Exactly.
Thor went into production after Joss Whedon basically became the quote-unquote showrunner.
Yeah.
Iron Man 3 was already in production when Avengers came out. And it was basically on the success of that and how well people responded in that, that Marvel came back to him and said, okay, look, you did such a great job of Avengers of tying everything together and doing such a good job. We want you to sort of have a stronger creative hand for the next, you know, big chunk of movies. And Captain America Winter Soldier was reportedly the first one where he was like really more hands-on. Because Thor, the script had been approved and it had already gone into sort of pre-production or actual filming, I think, when this decision was made. So it really, really, yeah, between that and sort of the it kind of makes sense that little elements of Iron Man 3 and Thor will kind of creep into the television show, but that we really haven't had anything major before now. Because even just watching this episode, you really, really get the sense that whatever's happening here is going to be connected some way to the movie that's just come out when we're recording this.
Yes,
that intertextuality is really starting to work in the show's favor.
Oh, and I was going to say, they don't even hide it. I mean, the fact that the teaser at the very end of this episode is a scene from early in The Winter Soldier just makes it incredibly clear that whether you know it or not, you've just watched roughly 18 episodes of a prologue to The Winter Soldier. At least from this particular direction. It's one of those things that they've been doing kind of with, what's the best way to do it? You know how when you have something like one of the new Star Trek films comes out, and they have like a comic series, you know, maybe four issues or whatever else, that serve to...
Yeah, they've done at least two series like that for both of the new movies, plus an ongoing one that's kind of
right.
A tie-in between that and the original series.
Right. But my thought is that you've got these little preludes, and there's been some that have done like web series that come out before the actual season comes out to kind of bridge you into the story. And what I see Agents of S.H.I.E.L.D. doing, in particular, it seems to work really well here because of the synergy that, you know, Captain America has with the S.H.I.E.L.D. related stuff versus, like I said, Thor really wasn't a great fit to try and have some kind of overlap regardless with Agents of S.H.I.E.L.D. because of the difference in approach in terms of the material. I mean, it's just not the most natural thing. Captain America, on the other hand, is very much a natural overlap. So it will be very interesting to see what the next episode of S.H.I.E.L.D. is. Extremely interesting. I just can't even emphasize that enough. The thing that took a little bit of
this is sort of the problem is that I feel like we can only have half a conversation about this episode because we're waiting on a part two and a part three, part two of which is in cinemas.
Well, and that's the weird thing is that it really is very odd because of the fact that this feels like the first part of a bigger story. And so it is very difficult to talk about. But at the same time, I think that the only thing that I would disagree a little bit with is that I still feel like they're trying too hard to sell Sky. Just a bit. There's still, you know, Ward being a bit obsessed over. There's still... I understand I'm not nearly as negative on Sky as some people are. I mean, there are people that literally hate the show because they want the character to die, like, tomorrow. But I'm also not, you know, incredibly sold on her either. I thought that she earned at this point what she's getting, but I'm more interested in what's going on with, okay, you've got this whole mystery going down with who's the mole in S.H.I.E.L.D. And they play up this whole thing with May. I thought that was incredibly well done because what I think is right there in front of you, and the characters haven't quite figured it out yet, is that if May isn't the one that is selling them down the river to the clairvoyant, she was still doing something behind their back. Who was she doing that for?
Oh yeah, she is. Oh no. That's not the impression I got. The impression I got is that she's absolutely selling them all down the river to the clairvoyant. She just doesn't realize that's who she's selling them down the river to. She thinks that she's keeping tabs on the team, on behalf of her next highest supervisor at S.H.I.E.L.D. Like this is all, and she would absolutely go along with it because it's the usual S.H.I.E.L.D. compartmentalization of information and all of that sort of thing. And she's freaking out at the end because she's trying to explain that, look, I'm just following orders, I'm just reporting back to S.H.I.E.L.D. and sort of stuff like that. Well, meanwhile, the other characters have realized, it's like, no, the problem is at S.H.I.E.L.D. Whoever it is that's doing all this is sort of on that end of it.
I'm going to disagree from this point of view. The clairvoyant does not know what happened with Coulson. The first hint that we get that she's not quite doing what we think she's doing is that she says Coulson knows. And the way that she says it makes it seem like she knows more about what happened with Coulson than Coulson does, because she's perhaps working for someone like Fury. That's because really I feel like Coulson's team is Fury's ace in the hole in a certain sense.
No, I get that. They're his they're his micro Avengers.
There you go.
In a sense. Like
they're his rescue plan.
They're his response team. They're his assembled under extremely similar circumstances. He wants people who are going to go around and basically sort out various threats on behalf of S.H.I.E.L.D., like a forward team able to deal with pretty much any kind of situation, work independently, do all of that kind of thing. The main difference is that A, obviously they're of a sort of like a lower they're not dealing with things that are quite as heavy. And B, part of the notion is that they're going to be a lot more loyal to him than the Avengers necessarily are. The Avengers do what they do because it's the right thing to do. But one of the arcs of the first Avengers movie was them sort of all coming to the realization that, okay, S.H.I.E.L.D. is kind of sus. We're not necessarily on board with what S.H.I.E.L.D. is doing, but we're working with them right now because the world needs saving. And, the Coulson's team are, by definition, you know, pretty much for the most part, well, now that they are all S.H.I.E.L.D. agents, there's a greater deal of loyalty inherent in that. But it's what I've suspected for a while is that what we're going to see in the show is them sort of also questioning their loyalty and having to decide whether or not, you know, the whole thing of like, are we going to be loyal to S.H.I.E.L.D. or are we going to be loyal to the ideals and the goals that we believe that we were upholding by being part of S.H.I.E.L.D.?
Yes.
And, I mean, I was saying from early on, I think this show's going to go in a very crusade direction. And what do you know? Called it.
Who do you serve and who do you trust?
I'd like to point out Crusade did not make it this far.
Okay, yes. We all know.
That's okay. Yeah, that's true. That's true. But I feel like there's very few B5 fans and Crusade fans who don't know the broad strokes of where Crusade was going to be going for the rest of its first season. And I think that Jed Whedon and Marissa Tancheron and Jeffrey Bell might have had a quick perusal of those scripts at some point. Because this feels very similar to the kind of thing that Straczynski was planning to do with that show.
Well, thankfully Coulson was already dead, so
Well, let's just throw out that there's
exactly
there's a couple of hours in your near future that are going to radically change your point of view about a few things, but
okay. Fair enough.
But that all being said, again, nothing that I've said, by the way, is in any way spoiling any of the outcome. I'm more curious as to how they're going to go from here, given what happens in the film, because of what they need to follow up on. Because, yeah, I mean, clearly the thing that happens at the end of this episode is that you get the sense that there's at least a section of S.H.I.E.L.D.
villainous element within S.H.I.E.L.D.
that is loyal, working for the clairvoyant. What that all entails,
no,
then.
What I'm assuming is that they are the clairvoyant. The clairvoyant is there. What I've assumed for a while is that the clairvoyant is some sort of smokescreen or whatnot. This is this is deep cover, off the books, all sorts of things like S.H.I.E.L.D.'s attempt to develop their own super soldiers, high technology, all of that kind of thing, and doing so in a way that's outside the purview of whether it's the World Security Council or Nick Fury or someone else. But it's just like it's the section. This is the Section 31 of S.H.I.E.L.D. And given how shady S.H.I.E.L.D. already is,
I'm just going to keep my mouth shut.
This episode neatly slotted into things that I had been sort of guessing or assuming about where the show was going to go and how it was going to depict S.H.I.E.L.D. and that sort of stuff like that, and also what my assumptions were based on trailers and whatnot of what's going to happen in The Winter Soldier. Like, watching a lot of that stuff, I had some distinct impression of, like, I think these are some of the story beats that are going to happen. And lo and behold, this episode really neatly fits into that.
Yes, and it's... You don't need to know anything...
But we only have half a conversation about
right.
it.
Right. You don't need to know anything about what happens from here to understand that the direction of this season and everything else, the direction all of this is going is the question of, what do you do when you find out that what you've given your loyalty to is not what you thought it was? At least partially, right? In this case, they trusted some of these people to, and they turned out to either be brainwashed or working for some other purpose, because I get the sense that there are a couple people that didn't even know that they were doing what they were doing. And then you have someone like Hand that seems very much like she knows what she's doing. So you've got a mixture there, but then for me, this is why I say I have no idea what it's going to look like even. You know, by the time this goes out, there's another episode. I have no idea what we just saw because I can't even predict where it's going to go because really I don't know what the characters are going to do with this knowledge because they are basically going to have to abandon what they thought was their safe ground. But how do they uphold the ideals that they've now come together to agree to and foster? So, yeah, I definitely get that crusade vibe to this. And I, at the same time, I kind of sit back and say, okay, maybe this is why they weren't all that worried about whether or not the ratings were all that good, because it kind of can go in all kinds of directions from here. But especially when you hear that they've got plans going through like 2028 for the overall Marvel Cinematic Universe. But anyhow, any other thoughts
on
this episode?
Yeah, that impressed me.
Yeah, yeah, if nothing else, the ambition is worthy of note and respect. Even if it completely falls apart.
Mind you, who thought they could pull off the Avengers? So at this point, I'm just like, look, you know what? Have a crack.
Yeah, exactly.
Why not?
I completely agree. Despite the fact that we've actually talked quite a bit about it while dancing around a few things, I think that it is absolutely true. What's startling about this episode, and I mean, Gary, Edmund, feel free to jump in if you have stuff to add to this, but it feels like what we've seen of this show up until this week, clearly the reason it's the end of the beginning is because the show is going to be irrevocably altered going forward. It's not going to be the same show we've been watching. And I almost feel bad for the people that dropped the show prior to this, because they're not going to necessarily be around to see the shift. And this is very much a shift.
I'm getting the impression that there might be a few people who suddenly pick it up again.
Maybe. Possibly.
Yeah.
Yeah, no, I just wanted to jump in. I mean, you guys have been covering the overall implications very, very well, but I thought just some of the smaller detail.
Look at how I'm hanging in there.
but just in terms of the dynamics of the episode, I loved figuring out the decrypted line basically in that very organic way of he's just trying to hack a little something that's a little outside the lines himself, and that's how he happens upon it. And I thought that the way that happened, and then the whole battle with May,
that was amazing.
It was just really showed how far they have come in establishing these characters and giving you their backgrounds and making them, you know, far, far more than just the kind of generic placeholders that some people might have felt they were in the first few episodes. And it was just used to set things up. And I'll just mention that I'm more on John's side as far as May goes. That whole even though it's just two words called Coulson knows just seems to throw things in a completely different direction. So my knee jerk reaction to that was always that she's talking to Fury, but I'll probably be completely wrong. But I hope to find out in the next few days.
Oh yeah, don't get me wrong. I expect that they're really going to take some time to deal with that. But my impression is still that she thinks she still thinks she as far as she knows she's on the side of the angels. she's on Coulson's side. But she's just doing the thing that she was. I swear we've seen it, if not other movies, then episodes of the TV show or something like that. Just the notion of like how compartmentalized S.H.I.E.L.D. is, like how, you know, people with different, you know. I know there's a good example. It's there on the tip of my tongue. Of just like the fact that like she is absolutely on Coulson's team. She's a contributing member. She likes them all. She's happy to be there. She's happy to help out. It's just she also has orders to call back into HQ and keep them up to date and keep HQ up to date on what's happening. And she doesn't really think anything bad of that.
Hmm.
Yep.
Well, rather than, since we went really long on this one, rather than go into a mid-show break, I think I'm just going to go ahead and let, Gary, why don't you do the next, or did you do Agents of S.H.I.E.L.D.?
I did just, Okay. Give someone else a turn.
Sorry, I lost track as I'm trying very desperately not to say certain things, but, Edmund, save
me. Edmund's thing does not count for you, John, today.
That's right.
Let's go in a completely different direction and talk about Lost Girl.
All right, and here's the promo.
Everything would be easier if the succubus was dead.
Sunday on Showcase.
You're not going to kill my granddaughter.
Destinies will be met.
I am a knight from the Order of Reyna, and I pledge my fealty to my queen.
Prophecies will be fulfilled.
Between the warrior and the queen, one of the two shall die.
And promises will be broken.
It chose you. And you broke my heart. Unclaim me.
Lost Girl. New episode Sunday at 10, exclusively on Showcase, where character is everything.
All right, and Edmund, if you could do the recap.
This is Lost Girl, season 3, episode 12, It Begins, also known as Origin. Bo is uncertain about assuming her role in a prophecy foretold by an order of knights until a surprising source helps her to choose. And I will give this a 6.
Okay. And Gary, how about you? Is Gary still there? Did we lose Gary?
Oh, yes. I'm going to go a little bit higher, and I'm going to go with a 7.
Okay. And Bronstone?
In my review, I actually went as high as an 8.
Okay.
Though not for any of the reasons discussed in the recap.
And I am going to go with a 7, I think. Okay. Well, Edmund, you gave this the lowest score out of everybody. What made this a 6 for you? That's actually the lowest score you've given for an episode this season. So.
Yeah. It's just starting to annoy me where it just really feels like we've talked about the way that they tend to. Just bring in new villains and have a pretty much a loose mythology where they can just come up with a new thing to insert as their whim requires, it seems, and it's primarily the reintroducing Massimo and having him be the one who takes out Hale, and then the Unimens have been taken out, and oh yes, and that means they all get gathered into this little nut that he can now eat and turn into the next big bad. All that was just not grabbing me, and sort of the cherry on top of all that was then when he calls the Morgan mother. It was like, oh yes, and let's just toss that into the mix as well. This was the culmination of my frustration with the yes, we're just gonna make stuff up as we go along as far as the background to this series goes.
Yeah,
get into the whole. I mean, the whole thing basically also applies to the whole Bo prophecy. And yes, we're doing this, and then yes, my knight is just going to burn herself up, and a big glowing door is going to appear.
Hmm. Yes. Now, Bronstam, you gave this an 8. Rebuttal? Difference of opinion? Where do we stand here?
I think that a lot of the main storyline involving Bo and Reyna and that sort of stuff was the weakest aspect of the episode. Where this won me over was in basically the follow-up to the previous episode. And a lot of that was due to some really, really good performances from members of the cast. Like, I felt the grief. I felt sadness. I felt the anger. I thought that was just really well communicated to me. And that put me in a good frame of mind, I guess, to watch the rest of the episode and see how a lot of the characters reacted. It sort of helped it kind of ties in interesting way to the fact that I thought that the Bo storyline was really, really weak, was the fact that at the same time, I was really in Kenzie's point of view of just like, why are you not helping her? Why are you not getting revenge? Why are you going off and doing this other thing? The stuff with you especially, I just thought was fantastic. I think she played that so well. And then meanwhile, I liked a lot of stuff that's going on with Lauren, because Zoe Palmer has always been this really, really solid member of the ensemble, who time and time again has just been able to carry storylines and episodes without any of the rest of the cast. Sorry, my computer just started doing something weird.
It's okay. We didn't notice over here.
Sorry about that. I thought that her stuff with Morgan was this is a character who has consistently been proactive and well played and well portrayed, and deals with a lot of stuff and comes to the other side. She's this real kind of, she's of both the characters and the actors, I think she's the real trooper of the bunch. They pretty much just throw anything at her and the soldiers on and makes it, you know, entertaining, or at least gets sort of a good dramatic mileage out of it. So it was all these secondary aspects about the episode that I just really, really loved. And then there was the main storyline, which was kind of they're building up the apocalyptic stuff, but it was weak. I don't really care that much about Raina one way or the other by this point. And if the doors are opening at the end of the episode, if that's not Gozer coming out of them, I think I'm going to be disappointed.
Well, it would certainly be a twist.
So nobody threw a giant marshmallow man.
Gary, what to add to this, do you think?
Well, no, I agree. You know, it's odd that who you would think would be the main character, Bo, was probably the weakest of the three storylines that I saw in this episode. You know, Kenzie just broke my heart. You know, here she's trying to avenge Hale, who was the former Ash, you know, who was in charge of all the Light Fae. You would think he'd have even more people on his side, but obviously he didn't. But at the same time, she tries everybody. You know, she tries Bo, she tries Dyson. She even goes to find Vex, for crying out loud, to try and find anyone in the world that will help her. And everyone just turns her down and says, no, we have to protect this guy. And I really fell for her. The actress did such a good job of portraying her heartache and her frustration and her anger. And, you know, as you see that scene where she's with Bo asking her to be released, you can just, you know, feel all the emotions rising up in her. It was the best part of the episode for me. And the other two plot lines, I agree. Raynor, I just have nothing invested in him. And then I blinked and they got married at some point. Where is that coming from? Then this whole, you know, they are throwing so many stuff, too many things, I think, to try, as Edmund said, to build up, you know, for the next villain of the week. You know, we had, we had a cult of horsewomen. We had some honor-bound knight who betrays her, you know, plus the wedding, plus the, you know, Massimo working to become the uber villain. It was just too much for one episode. I don't see how somebody can get invested in anything when they're slamming so many things up against the wall to see what sticks. Then you have the whole Lauren aspect that she's able to defay people now. you know, I would think that would almost make for an episode in itself, but no, let's cram that in here too, because we don't have enough going on right now. It seemed off. This whole episode just seemed like slammed with so many things. My head was spinning for it. Did you guys, like, I don't want to say lost, but like I said, just a little dizzy from the whole thing.
I still feel like I'm left with this feeling like they're doing too much of that, introducing these elements with no preamble whatsoever. That's been the main thing this season that's bugged me, because content-wise, I think that it's probably turned out to be the best season from our perspective, but again, it's this whole, you know, what are they doing for introductions. They seem to just throw stuff out there, and this was just another example of that. of more of those same problematic elements. I may not be explaining that particularly well, but you get the idea.
Yeah, I would just like to jump in just to clarify that my problem is with the storylines. I completely agree with what both Franz and Gary were saying in terms of the strength of the performances, but in my case, it was seeing all these strong performers having to try and wrestle with the storylines. It was part of what brought my rating down, because I really wish they'd have a better constructed story to tell us, because I know they'd be incredible at it.
Right, exactly. Well, what do we want to say here then? Any other thoughts on Lost Girl, or we defer them to the season finale?
Well, I just feel like they're getting too wrapped up in themselves. Like if they would just tell one or two stories at a time, not try to jam all these cool things at us at one time, it would lend itself towards a stronger story. They're just chucking in too many things anymore, and these uber villains of the month, that one ups the next one, is just getting tedious.
Yeah, I think I expressed that making Massimo kind of the big bad out of nowhere, it felt, was probably the weaker part for me. And everything kind of evolves from there at the moment. But, again, any other last thoughts on this one, or are we pretty much...
I think I'm going short of it.
Okay. That being said, Bronstom, next topic, if you don't mind.
Alrighty. What do we have here? Let's say we tackle some Being Human.
Okay, and here's the promo.
With only two episodes left. Everything they've done. Everyone they've hurt.
Oh my God.
Comes back.
Henry.
To haunt them. No! Being Human.
And if you could do the recap for us.
Sure. Being Human, Season 4, Episode 12, House Hunting. Moving day arrives for the roommates, who discover they aren't the only ones struggling with leaving the house.
Mm-hmm. And what would you give this one?
I gave this one an 8 out of 10.
Okay. And Gary? Interesting. Edmund?
No.
Oh, go ahead, Gary.
I think I'm just too emotionally involved in these characters to be completely objective anymore, so I'll go an 8.
Okay. And Edmund?
And I will take advantage of the new regime to go 8.5.
All right. And I gave it a 9. Let's see, Gary, I mean, you were saying emotionally invested. What character do you want to start with? I would probably say that at this point...
Well, no, they're all... No, actually, yeah.
Go ahead.
Well, I want to go... No, I mean, obviously, I've enjoyed these characters a lot, and I just found out all four of them are going to be at Dragon Con. Hooray. Anyway, this whole sort of, I guess, retro continuity to blame the house... for several of the ills that have occurred during the course of this season just seems a little too little and too late. And how much does that invalidate of everything else at this stage of the game? Do they really need to throw that in as the driving force for everything that's happened in the house? I feel it's a little bit of a cop out.
Interesting. I didn't really feel that way, obviously, but, Bronstone, Edmund, either one of you, what's your take on that?
I did feel like this was very late in the game to be introducing the concept of the house being a literal character, having, you know, in a sense. It's a thing that we talk about a lot with shows that have been going on for a while that have a sort of central location, is that the location has a bit of personality, but it feels like a character. Things like, you know, Firefly or Star Trek or whatnot, you know, seem like prime examples because they just have really strong recurring locations. We have like really strong ties to the characters. We begin to care about the location as much as the characters do. It feels like it's as important to the show. Taking the jump to having them literally have some sort of personality is not a bad thing, depending on when you do it. If you do it in the first episode, like say Farscape, well, you're not going to have a problem. If you do it later in the run, it's like, okay, that's interesting. You can adjust people to it. Do it in the second last episode. It's probably a bit late in the game to be pulling the trigger or something like that. The way that they were doing it, like in terms of how having it sort of be the blend of this and the personification of all the bloodshed and violence going on in the house and things like that, and then the way it acted, the way it put the characters in dire straits and stuff like that, was not that bit. I didn't mind that bit. I quite liked, but in the back of my head, I just got this thing of like, well, you're hanging the entire last couple of episodes of the show as a whole on a concept that you've just introduced, and rarely does that work out well.
See, I didn't have so much of a problem with it because it's not necessarily trying to go back and explain things so much as just shade them a bit.
Oh, I think it was trying to explain everything. You know, they were sort of insinuating it was everything from, you know, Sally dying and further on. So it goes back to, you know, question everybody's motivations.
I don't know that it necessarily changes what the characters were deciding to do or their reactions to things. But, Edmund, how about... because that has to happen every time we record teams now. All right. You can hear me now? Hello.
Hello, John.
Hello.
All right, so that happens every time now, it seems. Anyway, Edmund, what was your take on this in particular, this idea?
Yeah, my take was I hadn't thought about it in quite such extreme terms. Certainly in the context of this episode, I mean, I like the dramatic device of having all of our main characters forced into these major reevaluations of themselves or evaluations of themselves, and this whole idea of having their buttons pushed to this extent. I haven't necessarily taken it as that Ramona was driving this. I think to a certain extent she's been feeding off of it, and it's more the catalyst was more the prospect of them leaving is what's been upping the ante and forcing her to show herself she really has been more background figure.
Six of that and Sally having discovered more about her.
Mm-hmm.
Now Sally, you know, sort of got on the trail by accident, found out that she's there and whatnot, so she's being a bit more open about her own presence. But yeah, no, I'm with you on that one. I think that it's only this episode where we see her actually take any kind of active part in what's going on. Other than that, she's just sort of like, she gets a kick out of blood and violence, and having these guys around has just been brilliant for that because they seem to attract it. If anything, I'd say there's maybe a little bit of ambiguity as to whether or not they're bringing the violence to her, or she's kind of maybe subtly affecting things, bringing the violence to them. But either way, I feel like she's been a much more passive presence. I feel they're trying to establish that she's been a much more passive presence up to mm-hmm. this point.
Yeah, and certainly, it was taking out Sally's brother was sort of the first really active thing that she seems to have done. And even with Josh, I mean, she obviously couldn't make him transform, but did set up the situation where she knew she could essentially force him to transform with Nora in danger and him frustrated and locked out. The funny thing about discussing this after Lost Girl was... I hadn't really made the connection. I was when Rainier got introduced, I was like, yeah, he looks familiar, but I hadn't quite thought about who he was. And seeing him come back as Henry and see his scenes with Aiden, it was just a reminder of, oh yes, okay, yes, he really can act. It's just the problem is they're not letting him do anything on Lost Girls. So one of my takes from that whole scene was. Even though I guess, given the ending they were heading towards, they had to introduce Kenny and his super compulsion ability. It still made me feel like maybe there was a lost opportunity here because I think Aiden sparring with Henry as his main son could have been more interesting in the final season. I guess that's one of the dangers you run of bringing back past characters like that. Sometimes does not reflect reflect as well on the decisions you've made since. There was one thing I heard offline that apparently we can not that Nora and Emily was a bad pairing, but apparently we can have hold something else against Revolution, because but for Revolution it would have been her and Bryn, which would have been quite intriguing.
Except for I like seeing Emily a lot more. So. She just has a certain flair to her, you know? I don't know. Her attitude is always fun, even if it's an evil version of her.
She's always been a good presence. Chief example of the fact that is the fact that she was there in the first episode. Like in that opening two-parter, she was a big part of that story. She's part of what gave the show a bit of a distinct flavor from the original British version by giving, you know, adding new wrinkles to the dynamics with the other characters. And right off the bat, they put her in some danger to generate some tension. So it's kind of fitting that they're back this close to the end, because I think that maybe not necessarily an integral part, but like, I look back on the first episode, I was like, no, she was a good part of the reason why I enjoyed those first couple of episodes and therefore was willing to give the show a chance.
Agreed. All right, any other last thoughts on this episode, this penultimate episode of Being Human? No? Okay.
Yeah, I'm really looking forward to seeing the conclude, like how that cliffhanger goes. Even though it's still, like there's a trailer at the end of the episode, it's just like, this is, you set up. I was just on the edge of my seat as the final moments of that episode rolled around, sort of realizing at the same time, Sally, we've been here before.
Mm-hmm.
And yeah, I'm eager to see what happens, and at the same time, not eager to have the show go away.
Well, there's such a thing as going out when you're still strong, so that's for sure for this show. Thank you, gentlemen, for all your help for this episode. And definitely, if you want to give us some comments, you can follow us on Twitter at Critical Myth, or you can go and like our page on Facebook. Again, that's Critical Myth.
You can give us feedback by visiting the website over at www.criticalmyth.com. Just check out the entries for the show and leave us a comment. If you can't find it, just go all the way up to the top of the page. There's a link there, and there is also a drop-down box for all of the shows we talk about. So please let us know what you think.
Or you can go over to the VOG Network page and go over to the forums, and we have a dedicated forum for the show. You can leave comments there for us.
You can also email your feedback to feedback@criticalmyth.com, or you can leave us a review on iTunes.
Or you can call our Google voicemail line at 908-977-MYTH. That's 908-977-6984.
And don't forget that Critical Myth's use of any and all copyright material is only intended for parody, news analysis, critique, or for educational purposes, as provided within United States Code Title 17, also known as the Fair Use Act. Please don't sue us.
And the comments and opinions of the Critical Myth podcasters and reviewers are not necessarily those of its distributors, partners, or affiliates. But let's face it, we're probably right anyway. So until next time...